I'm a psychologist by trade. Supposedly, a psychologist is a scientist who aims to study human behavior. And the purpose of studying the human behavior and experience, according to the various textbooks, is to understand man's experience and behavior. And so the textbooks go in order to predict it and control it. This supposedly is the charge that we psychologists have, except that I renege on it. I've been trained, like most psychologists, and I see my mission as one of understanding man, to find out what are the things that determine his being and his behavior and his experience. But it's at this point that I draw a sharp division between myself and some of my colleagues, most of my colleagues. I want to find out what are the things that could determine man in order to subvert them, transcend them, in short, to study man with a view toward maximizing his freedom from determiners, his ability to transcend his past, his genetic endowment, social pressures, and to discover what his possibilities might be and to fulfill them. As a psychologist, I carry out my work in a number of ways. I'm a teacher, so I teach students and aim to the best of my ability to turn them on, to wake them up, to be what you might call a psychedelic teacher to them, to be a human substitute for LSD or pot. Another branch of what I do is what for a long time I called psychotherapy, but I don't like to call it psychotherapy anymore because that implies that the people with whom I do this are sick, and this raises a whole new question that's begun to exercise me more and more. For years past, I was very much uncomfortable with the whole field of abnormal psychology and psychiatry. I used to teach abnormal psychology. It was one of the most popular courses at the University of Florida. I'm a good lecturer. But I came gradually, through a number of experiences, to realize that what we call abnormal psychology or psychiatric nosology is actually a very peculiar kind of politics. It's a kind of invalidation of those ways of behaving and experiencing that for one reason or another don't fit the existing social system. It's as if each society decides what range of human possibility will be regarded as sane and good for that time and place, and everything else that doesn't fit those criteria of what's sane and good are going to be disqualified and punished and regarded as evil and insane. This growing realization that psychiatry and clinical psychology and to some extent social work and to some extent the ministry that concerns itself with pastoral counseling, the realization that people who practice this counseling and psychotherapeutic art, the realization that these people are political counter-revolutionaries, the realization that they are the velvet glove at the end of the steel fist of social control, came most sharply to me in the past year when I went out of the country and spent a year in London, both studying existential phenomenology and just being away from what I usually do. And in that time and place, being out of the country and at the same time out of my American mind, it became increasingly apparent to me, as a very serious professional student of man, committed to enlarging his possibilities, it became apparent to me that that if I wanted to do my job the way I was beginning to see it, I would have, among other things, to reread the Marx that I studied, that's M-A-R-X, that I studied when I was an undergraduate at the University of Toronto. Not to become a Marxist revolutionary, but to reacquaint myself with Karl Marx's perspective on how social systems work, how they come to be stratified into classes with a minority dominant class and then a larger mass of people who were socialized and trained to fit certain roles in the social system that they would have to fit in order to keep the social system going, in order, in turn, to perpetuate the privilege of the few against the mystified being of the many. When I say mystified, I mean people who have been brainwashed or propagandized into believing that as they work and conduct their family life and personal life and leisure life, they're mystified into believing that this is for their own good, but in actuality they are perpetuating a social system that benefits the few at the cost of the many. Well, this period of time of being out of the country, and you might say out of my American mind, this reacquaintance with some ideas that I'd studied years ago, gave me a fresh perspective on what physicians and ministers and psychologists and social workers and personnel and guidance people are doing, what it amounts to is that they are taking people who have lived a way of life that they have been trained to live and which dispirits them, loses meaning for them, and results in their finding that way unlivable. It may be unlivable because they develop what a physician would call physical complaints: cancer, tuberculosis, hemorrhoids, peptic ulcer, circulatory accidents, or they can't live that life anymore because they have what a psychiatrist might call a psychotic episode, a neurotic eruption of symptomatology, and so on. These outcomes are the result of living a way of life that simply is not fit for human tissue. And when people find that they cannot go on being a husband, wife, mother, father, son, daughter, worker in the way that they had, and when they are called sick, then what happens is that they are treated by some one of these professions, the medical profession, psychologic, the ministry, or whatever, and either patched up, tranquilized, persuaded, or biologically reduced with lobotomies, electroshock, freezing, tranquilizers, and whatnot, so that they can get back to being the way that is conventionally deemed normal and healthy. They are treated in a way that gets them back to the very way of life that did them in. This realization, as I say, that I was part of this whole political arena gave me pause and made me wonder just what in heaven's name am I up to as a serious student of human being and one who aims one way or another to enlarge human possibility and human freedom and so on. And so I came to realize that somebody like Thomas Zass, who wrote very effectively about the myth of mental illness, was in some ways an ally, that what we're calling mental illness, well, the term mental illness is no more than a metaphor that's outlived its usefulness, that it's a way of invalidating human possibilities that for one reason or another happen to be socially inconvenient or in some way threatening to an existing status quo. And I came to realize then that physicians who treat with drugs and pills and knives, and psychiatrists who treat with persuasion and with drugs, and to some extent with surgery, and then psychologists and social workers and ministers who follow the example of the physicians, that these are not healers and these are not scientists. They are political agents. And I came to realize that in some ways the healers, the so-called healers of our society, who treat people who have broken down because of the very way that they have lived and who get people back into that way of life, are in some ways commissars. Commissars, as I said before, with a velvet glove. They are getting people to stifle what could be rational and effective dissent that could lead to constructive change in the way a society organizes itself. During this period, as I say, when I was out of the country and out of my usual occupation, I came to realize too that the researchers in my profession, among which I number myself, I'm a researcher too, were in some ways part of the same collusion with, well, let's give it a name, with the upper middle class, let's say. They were in collusion with the branch of our society which benefits most from the way it's organized, that the psychological, and I'll add the sociological investigators who sought to point to the determiners of human behavior, that in a sense, they and I was one of them, were kept men, a kind of scientific whore. We were spying on our fellow man, inviting him to trust us, inviting him to show us and tell us what his life was like, tell us his life history, let us look at him while he did experiments in our laboratories, and we would say, when you participate in this sort of thing, and when you tell us your life history, you are helping science. This is what we would say. But then when I looked with a certain amount of ruthless honesty at what we did with these findings, was we offered them to business, government, education, the large institutions of our society, to help the leaders of these institutions the better to manipulate and control the existences of the very people who in good faith had showed us their being. Now this came as something of a guilt-producing revelation to me, that in a sense, as a scientific investigator, I was kind of a spy. But I was asking people, really, I was mystifying people to spy on themselves and then tell me what they had found, and then I would analyze this data according to the best scientific canons, write reports, and present them in the literature, or as some of my colleagues would, present them to whoever underwrote the grant that they were working on, and then these findings would increase the power of somebody or other to manipulate and control the very people who had provided this data. I should add that this realization came out of my own investigations into self-disclosure, where I came to realize that even behavior, the kind of behavior that a behaviorist studies, is a kind of self-disclosure. I came also to the realization that my colleagues who call themselves behaviorists, who dispense with an interest in what people think and feel, and they're only interested in actions that flip a lever and leave a mark on an instrument or something, that they mislead themselves into thinking that they've dispensed with human consciousness and experience. They're dealing with a kind of human self-disclosure that's in some code other than words. Action is a code. Behavior is a code. It has to be deciphered. It has a meaning. And I came to realize, after talking to a bunch of people who had served as subjects in researches, including my own, that they had lied to the investigators, that they had misrepresented what their experience was to the investigators, that the horrible and yet fascinating possibility presented itself to me that most of our published psychology, psychiatry, and sociology, insofar as it was based on the performance and the disclosure of human beings who didn't trust or know the investigator, might turn out in 100 years to be nothing more than a big fat lie told by the subjects to the gullible investigator, or a dirty joke that the subjects have been playing on investigators. Not really a dirty joke. You might say that investigators get the data that they deserve. If they're trustworthy, they get trustworthy data. If they're strangers to the subject and don't take the trouble to make themselves known to the person they're studying, then they probably get a pack of lies. Well, this period of being out of the country and, as I say, out of my usual frame of mind, gave me some perspectives and some occasions for, at first, despair about my trade. I thought I would get out of my trade after being in it for 20 years. And then I decided, hell no, there are other possibilities here. There is a possibility of both investigating man in a way that will help the very person who is being studied to demystify him, enlighten him as to the forces that could affect his destiny if he were unaware of them, but which he could transcend if he were aware of them. This offered a new possibility, new dimensions for psychological research. And in my work as a psychotherapist, I began to see, not all at once, this is a gradual thing over a 5, almost 10-year period, that what we once knew as technique in psychotherapy, when you look at it carefully, is just a glorified kind of scientific manipulation, where the tacit premise is that if you follow this technique faithfully, then cure or behavior change or attitudinal change or something will happen. But we know better now. We know that this is twaddle, that psychotherapy is either a brainwashing kind of operation from a high status person issuing from a high status person to a low status sufferer, or it's an educational venture on the part of one person who is suffering, seeking something from a fellow seeker who happens to be called a psychotherapist. And psychotherapy then becomes more like a dialogue between fellow seekers, one of whom is somewhat more enlightened than the other, but who is not practicing a scientific manipulative art. He is instead practicing the time-honored art of the teacher, the guru. And so I began to see that psychotherapy then need not be the manipulative effort of someone who in an unenlightened way is a representative, let's say, of the middle or upper middle class. It can instead be an encounter between fellow seekers, one of whom is more enlightened than the other, and who seeks to help the other person gain an understanding of the determiners that are keeping him frozen in one way of being, in order that he might transcend them and enlarge his degrees of freedom and his ability to choose and follow his own existence. Well, these then are some of the realizations that have grown on me over the past few years, and the directions in which the different phases of my work have moved following on the realization. We're in the middle of a revolution. I'm one of the revolutionaries. But there's no plot, and there's no leaders. It's more of a groping effort, and it's not an academic matter, as a matter of fact, because whether or not this revolution succeeds, I'll put it another way, the way I experience it is this, that it's literally true that the fate of the human world depends on whether or not this revolution in our thinking and praxis about man changes directions. We need an intelligent way to organize society, not the way Skinner suggested it in Walden 2, not the way Huxley suggested it, not the way Orwell suggested it.
Nor Hitler.
Although possibly the way Ben Gurion.
Well, I don't know. But he's also looking for blonde, right?
Yeah. We need a way to organize society. But
would you elaborate on why?
Actually, I don't think we have the choice. It seems, to my knowledge, that so long as human beings have existed, they have organized themselves, not necessarily self-consciously, into a social system where people have roles and statuses and power differential and so on. But in so doing, there's always a cost involved. And we're arriving at the time now where the reasons for organizing the way we have organized, let's say in the Western world for the past 300 years, have become obsolete. We're rapidly approaching, for example, an automated society, very much like ancient Greece, where in ancient Greece the automation was provided by slaves. Now our automation is going to be provided by machines. And this means that our ways of educating, our ways of raising children, our ways for men and women to get along with each other, our ways of entertaining ourselves, have all become obsolete. They already are obsolete. Our healers, seen from this perspective, instead of seeking new ways to organize life that will liberate and enlarge human possibilities, have, as it were, committed themselves to an outmoded social system, an outmoded economic base, in some ways an outmoded political arrangement. And I happen to belong to that healing and the healing and the educating professions. Our education system, of course, is not an education system. It's a training system. It trains people for the middle class. You don't get an education in grammar school, high school, or college. You get shaped and polished to join some establishment or other. The professors who are authentic teachers, who expose people, who seduce young people into looking at what man has been and what he might be, and offer him a kind of dissenting perspective on the status quo, these men get fired. So that we don't have educators, we don't have teachers, we have trainers.
Technicians.
behavior and attitude shapers.
Healer technicians.
I wouldn't call them healers.
Not those, but the so-called healer technicians.
Yeah. Let me tell you about a high-level conference I attended, which bears exactly on this point. It was an invitational conference on independent learning in Wisconsin about 4 months ago. People who sponsored this thing opened up the proceedings with a circular that said something like this. As more and more people are going to school, and as the image of man is changing because of research findings from the behavioral sciences, we are realizing that man has the capacity and the responsibility to take charge of his own education. Man has to learn how to learn by himself, for himself, was what this conference was about. And a number of us were asked to give papers. And I discovered that the way in which the people had addressed this question of what do we know about independent learning and how can we foster more of it was to have more and more teaching machines and programmed instruction. This is the answer that is offered by behavioral science to the question, how can individuals take care of their own instruction? But teaching machines and programmed instruction is simply another kind of very efficient training. It's a way of taking textbooks or syllabi, and organizing them in scientifically selected incremental steps so that a predetermined objective will be arrived at, namely the ability to answer a certain repertoire of questions. And of course, this is not education. This is training. But this is the way the question of how to turn people on, how to educate people, is currently being addressed, you might say, in the establishment. Of course, I sailed in with a wild paper I called Fascination, a Theory of Independent Learning, and I addressed the question of how do you drive people out of their minds, which is what education properly is. You invite them, you seduce them out of their present preoccupations, you introduce them to new possibilities, and then pray that some one of the possibilities that you've introduced them to will fascinate them, and then they'll get, as a beatnik would put it, hung up on a new possibility until that wears out. Then they have to die a little, go back into themselves, and then come out again to see the world in a new way, let it extend another invitation to them that fascinates them, and go on. Of course, this can't be programmed. I have a mixed view of, let's say, the acid heads and the pot heads and the ones who opt out. I look at it in kind of a dialectical context. We have the establishment cranking out a way to live, and they are helped by physicians, professors, teachers, the press, the television, all aiming to produce mass man, modal man. A quick digression. I just drove 3,600 miles from the east to the west, and I've never been more bored in my life. Every single town, the hills and the temperature changes, and to some extent the accents change. But in every single town, you have a Ramada Inn, a Holiday Inn, a Gulf station, a Standard Oil station. You have radios that play the same god-awful music, the same hideous ads. The newspapers vary somewhat in who is getting married and who the local team is, but all the news stories come from United Press, Associated Press, and so on. Every store has the identical products, the same bread, the same drugs, the same booze. There is absolutely no variety. It is the most horrifying and stupefying and boring experience I've had. The only joy I had was I was driving a TR3 and I was anxious. Every step of the 3,600 miles, would it blow up? Would it make it? Would a bolt drop off? But the uniformity, when you look at it cold, is absolutely fantastic. And I began to have fantasies as I was driving that the whole purpose. I have a radio and you can hardly hear it with a noisy TR3 engine and the wind whistling, but I would listen so some music might play. And I saw that the aim of this was to attract your attention and to get you into a passive, receptive mood, because after 3 minutes of music, bang, an ad would come and rape you. And I know enough about how conditioning works that the whole function of conditioning is to functionally decorticate you in order that the lower brain centers can be more directly affected. And of course, radio, television, and so on serve this function nicely. They decorticate you in order that you can get the serious business, which is to buy this toilet paper or that tobacco. And what is that a digression from?
But yet your society of the mass, yet your mass consciousness is highly historic.
Historic or hysteric?
No, historic. Well, it's hysteric too. It's highly historic. This is way into whatever man has been. Whether it's a little group or a large group, doesn't matter. Not what the number of people is. It's more like a government.
Well, I think I'm not really enlightened enough to say this as more than an opinion. But I think we finally arrived at the time where the more enlightened consciousnesses have finally got to stand forth and make a serious pitch to take the control of education, domestic government policy, foreign government policy, out of the hands of the unenlightened. The unenlightened are the businessmen. These are the ones who, the businessmen and all the subsidiary institutions like the military, the education institution, I don't call them education anymore, the training institutions. And the medical profession and its acolytes, which include many of my colleagues. But I don't quite know how this is going to happen. All I know is that those people who are more or less thinking and working seriously along lines that I see myself doing will simply have to continue vigorously to, and cunningly, I suppose, to do their work in the way that is most meaningful to them. As human beings, we're subject to limits, we're subject to biological pressures, social pressures, the momentum and inertia of habit, and so on, the kinds of things that the behavioral sciences have investigated pretty thoroughly. But we also are, as Sartre puts it, condemned to freedom. And from this perspective, we face an option. We can be in this world, according to the view that I work from, we can be in this world as determined beings, or we can be in this world as free, transcending beings. And scientists, behavior scientists, have to function like other kinds of scientists, namely to find out and measure just what are the determiners in this world. And to this extent, I'm like any of my colleagues. I'm a disciplined investigator. I try to find the determiners, and I try to measure them, and I try to weigh them one way or the other. But it's at this point that a choice arises. Once you have specified determiners, you then have an option. You can conceal the existence of these determiners from the people whom they affect, and this puts you in a position of being one up on them, you see. And once you know what they are, and you get a lever on them, you can manipulate the determiners and hence manipulate behavior. Just read Skinner's book, Science and Human Behavior, for the most forceful, brilliant analysis of how this is possible and how, in fact, it's being done. And the other option is to call it to somebody's attention that these determiners exist, and it's really up to you whether you acquiesce to them or play judo with them and maybe invite their thrust behind you in the pursuit of your own freely chosen projects. I happen to see, we'll call it humanistic psychology, as serving this mission. It's identical up to a point with the mission of Division 3 of the APA and the Psychonomic Society and so on, to find out what are the determiners that affect behavior and experience. And at that point, we part company, because the psychonomicist, the Division 3 man, exempts himself from political, philosophical questions. For him, they've been settled. He's a positivist, and usually an upwardly mobile middle-class man, or else he separates his political and religious and ethical views from science. And so, in effect, he is a colluder with the status quo, or he's an employer of the Space Administration, General Motors, an employee, I should say, of one of these institutions. Or he takes another position and says, all right, I have a privileged glimpse of the undoubted determiners that affect man. I can study them. And in fact, I ask subjects to show themselves to me so I can find out what these determiners are. Then I have a choice. I can either keep him in the dark as to what I found out and whisper it to the people who have underwritten my grant, or I can say, look, you have shown me how you learn, how you perceive, you've told me about your past, you've told me about your marriage, or whatever, you've told me your secrets, or you've showed them to me. I'm a trained man. I discover certain determiners that are affecting your existence. I'm now going to point them out to you so that if you find that these determiners are getting in your way of enlarging your existence, discovering new possibilities, and so on, this is what you might do to get around them. And in fact, one can develop whole applied sciences of transcendence. This is in fact what the applied science of, expanding your ability to learn, expanding your ability to read, enlarging your capacity to remember, enlarging your capacity to enter into dialogue with another human being. These are applied sciences that work only because somebody has discovered what the determiners are. This is a side thought. You'll forgive the unsystematic talk. One of the things that occurred to me in my period of meditation on what the hell I'd been doing for 20 years was this, that the institutions have the wealth and they hire behavioral scientists and they don't spend money unless they get something in return. So that you have psychologists, psychiatrists, sociologists, and so on, for the institution. They study man for the institution. Now, who then is the student of man for the individual person? Who is the psychologist for the person? Well, it turns out to be the psychiatrist, the psychotherapist. But the psychotherapist has priced himself way beyond the range of the individual. And so a very worthwhile mission is for more and more physicians, psychologists, psychiatrists, sociologists, and anthropologists to study man for the individual instead of for the institution. You know, you actually have occupational medicine, occupational sociology, occupational psychology, psychology for the individual, medicine for the individual, is much more rare. And I see, in a way, the hope of the next 50 years being more and more professionals waking up philosophically, politically, economically, as to who they are and where they fit into the social system, and what are their intentions vis-a-vis the individual man. Do they aim to keep him mystified and muddled, or do they aim to turn him on, wake him up? As fast as we discover determiners, it then instantly becomes possible to transcend them. To discover a determiner means to discover predictability in human existence. And as fast as this predictability is discovered, the one who has been predicted can change rules, can change the game. There is enough predictability about general human existence that when somebody is able to find out what the predictors are, they can capitalize on it. In a poker game, for example, if you notice, like, who wrote that classic on poker? Yardley on poker. When he was learning poker, he noticed that when the guy had a losing hand, he always bet his money with his left hand. And Yardley got rich just by watching with which hand. Certainly, people have automatisms in their behavior which they can transcend if they choose, if they're aware of them. And so long as they're not aware of them, someone else can watch them like a machine, find out what the regularities are, and profit from that knowledge. But so soon as a person realizes, one, that he's being used without his knowledge and consent, and two, he's being used in a way that doesn't benefit him, he can foul it up. Now let me give you some very concrete examples. One, I had a colleague who is a very brilliant both classical conditioning expert and operant conditioning expert. He has many publications. He's internationally known. To come into his presence is to feel, if you have a vivid imagination, and I do, as soon as you come into the same room with this chap, you can feel the hooks extending from him. He's trying to get the hooks in, and then they're in, and then he starts pulling them, and you begin to get the feeling that you're being manipulated, that you're in the presence of a con artist and a persuasion artist and someone who has studied you to find out what your reinforcers are, and he's going to slip the pellets out. And As I say, if you're at all enlightened, you discover this, and you either punch him in the nose or get away from him as fast as you can. The only people who hang around this fellow, his students and so on, are the nebbishes and the slobs, the stupid ones. People whom he would like as his friends and colleagues stay away from him in droves. It's possible, in short, once one realizes that one has been used, to leave the scene or to eliminate the manipulator. It's sort of like Arthur Kessler's story the story of a Russian, a cultural attaché having an affair with the daughter of an American ambassador, and he is the new Soviet man, a master of Pavlovian conditioning. And when he tells a joke, he puts a joke-telling face on. When he's making love, he puts a love-making face on. And the girl notices this, but she doesn't know everything that's going on. And later in the story, toward the denouement, he explains to her how he has shaped her. And she can't believe it. And at one point, if I recall correctly, he explains how in making love, he always tweaks her on the bosom right at the point of climax. And she can't believe this. So he reaches over, gets her to lie on a sofa, and he tweaks her bosom, and she has a climax. And she is so horrified that she shoots him in the belly with a pistol. Now this, presumably, he could have anticipated, but it's pretty hard to... it's a winning game to try to manipulate and control human beings up to a point, but you can't keep ahead of it. I think even in Notes from the Underground, the poor sad sack who anticipates automation and the IBM man and so on, the cart mentioned. He says even when things are all worked out, there'll still be somebody who will bend his card. And of course, as a humanistic scientist, I take a committed stand to enlarge the ability of the card bender to do so. I try to help that person find out how it came to pass that he arrived at that situation, and then I explore with him by any and all means that I can find, or that we can invent or improvise, means by which he can break that trap and find new goals, new values, new ways, and so on. And this can only happen when that fellow trusts me. And this will only happen when I prove trustworthy. And I can't fake trustworthiness. I have to let him know who I am and what I'm up to. And this comes to pass in our conversations. And I contrast this with the way I was trained to be a psychotherapist. And it's radically different. In point of fact, if you listen to tape recordings of psychotherapists, you have no difficulty whatsoever telling who the patient is and who the therapist is, because they play their parts with exquisite finesse. Hollywood would recruit one or the other for the appropriate part. And this was quite true of me. I used to practice psychotherapist in a way that my supervisors would be proud of. But now it's much more like a conversation between two peers, or a big brother, a teacher, and a pupil. But sometimes the teacher confesses that, by God, he's having the same trouble. Maybe we can work the same kind of trouble out together. But two people seeking to gain further illumination about their existence and greater degrees of freedom in the living of their lives. This, incidentally, is the way psychotherapy is going to have to go, and it is going. It's taking time, because To the extent that psychotherapists have followed the medical model of fast turnover, maximum financial gain, then to that extent you get resistance to any different views as to what psychotherapy is or can be. But more and more, the people who have become psychotherapists, whether psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, ministers, very, very often are high IQ people. And very often they've gone into the trade out of a sincere conviction that they want to be helpful. And they realize that the way that they are trained is only a beginning and that they've got to transcend it. And I think in 25 years, either all psychotherapists will be shot and imprisoned or abolished because they are an innovating, fermenting force in society that are weakening the official agencies of social control. That's one alternative. And the other alternative is that they will be commissioned by society to do exactly this, because without that, since the universities, for example, are not providing people with, I don't like to use the word psychedelic because it's gotten all tied up with LSD and so on, but educational is better. Since the universities aren't educating in the Socratic sense, then somebody has got to. Where the hell are the teachers going to come? And I think there's a very good possibility that the possibly 10,000 qualified psychotherapists in the United States and the 1,000 in Britain and the 500 in Germany, the 300 in France, wherever, may well, wouldn't this be ludicrous, may well become the educators of the future until a new cadre of educators show up on the scene in the academies, the universities, where they properly ought to be. There are two words that occur to me as a way of summarizing the thinking and research that I've done myself. One of them is courage, and the other one is commitment to some project or other. And I suppose the commitment to some project or other is prior. If you choose some future for yourself, that's what a project is. You project yourself into the future. There's all kinds of determiners that have a thrust with a certain measurable force connected with them, and you can either acquiesce to them, which is a free project, which you actually make. It's a decision you make every day. Shall I acquiesce today, or shall I transcend? Marx said, if you want to understand the structure of the world, try to change it. So you invent this future, and you try to transmute it from an imaginary being into a perceptual being. Right now, this new future exists in fantasy or imagination. It has a being. It has an imaginary being. You want to transmute it. It's an alchemical process. You want to transmute that imaginary being into a perceptual being. And now there are a million things that stand between that you and that alchemical transmutation. There's your parents, social pressure, public opinion, guilt, compassion, inertia, and God knows what all, each one of which tends to keep you in the way that you now are and to prevent that imaginary being from being transmuted into a being that can be perceived by other people.